You're listening to the winning literary show, Off the Shelf Books Talk Radio, live with host Denise Turney, author of the books Long Walk Up, Portia, Love Pour Over Me, Spiral, Love Has Many Faces, and Rosetta's Great Hope. Turn up your dial and get ready for a blast of feature author interviews, 411 on book festivals, writing conferences, and so much more. Ready? Let's go.
Successful entrepreneurs are givers and not takers of positive energy. That's an anonymous quote, and I want to welcome you. I have this little Snoopy typing on a typewriter, being that I'm a writer with a he's on his doghouse, and you can, it's like a calendar. You just turn the months and the days. I said, oh, my goodness, it's the middle of November already. You guys, I really encourage you as we come down the home stretch of 2020, despite everything that's happened this year, you can still make this a phenomenally good year for yourself. I encourage you to take those steps to do that even now. And then today, our author, the guest that we have on, can offer you such a healthy dose of entertainment this morning. So I want to welcome you to our November the 14th, 2020 show. And for our loyal listeners, thank you for being here with us for 16 years. And if it's your first time listening to Off the Shelf, I got to let you know that you are listening to the winning book radio show, Off the Shelf. Two things I want to ask you. How important is self-care to you? Do you practice awareness so you can become aware of when you're starting to make decisions that might be leading you away from joy and peace? Feeling loved and maybe even loving yourself, that is so important to catch yourself early and then choose again, make another choice. And there are techniques in a book I recently released, Awaken Blessings of Inner Love, Shortcuts to Self-Care Techniques to Lead to Success in a Busy World. Our world's so busy. But every single day it's important to take care of yourself, because we don't know what's coming. As I was telling somebody on the interview yesterday, if you don't practice daily self-care, if you don't practice awareness and catch yourself early, something could come around the corner and literally knock you out. It's just like a good boxer. You got to stay in shape, practice awareness, stay sharp, and know when to pivot and shift and choose again. You made a mistake? Okay, choose again and go a different way. So that's the first thing I ask you, and again, a helpful book, Awaken Blessings of Inner Love by Denise Turney. I encourage you to pick up a copy. It's an ebook or in print. And also, you mystery sleuths, those of you who value romance and you like relationships, one day I'm going to do another reading from Love Pour Over Me here on Off the Shelf. But I encourage you to get a copy of Love Pour Over Me. This is fiction. The first book's nonfiction. This is fiction. It's in ebook and in print format as well. You can get it on Barnes & Noble, Amazon, Walmart, Kobo, Target, Google Books, you name it. Just go get yourself a copy of one or both of the books today and start reading them and see how they bless your life. And now let us go and meet our very special off-the-shelf guest. And our special off-the-shelf guest this morning is Jeff Rosley, hopefully I said his name correctly. Jeff makes his home in Indianapolis. His first published work was a poem that was published in the Hanover College Fine Arts Journal. That's pretty impressive. He's an avid traveler. In fact, Jeff leads Himalayan treks and mountaineering expeditions. He has scuba dived throughout the Caribbean and sea kayaked and Palo, Tonga, and the Greek Isles. He is also an avid social activist. He earned his Bachelor of Arts from the University of Chicago. He was a ladder winner in swimming and football, and he has also earned a JD from Indiana University Law School. To date, Jeff has authored 10 books, which include Polarized, Hero's Journey, Island Adventures, Bringing Progress to Paradise, and False Prophet. You guys can hop on over to his website now and check him out, jeffreyrosley.com, jeffreyrasley.com. And again, that's jeffreyrasley.com. We are absolutely honored to have Jeff with us on Off the Shelf this morning. Welcome to Off the Shelf, Jeff.
Thank you, Denise. It is good to be with you the day after Friday the 13th.
Yes, it is. And you know what? Nothing happened. I never really believed in that, but some people do. And yes, good to be here on November the 14th. So the first two questions that I'm going to ask you, I ask every guest who comes on the show. And I generally tell our guests when I started Off the Shelf years and years ago, we were on Rainbow, so I would just go right into the questions and listeners would send me emails. Please don't do that. Please let us tell us a little about the guests before you start talking about their books. So to begin, could you tell Off the Shelf listeners where you grew up and what life was like for you growing up?
I grew up in Goshen, Indiana, which when I was growing up, the population was about 10,000. It's now about 35,000, so the population growth has been really dramatic because of the RV industry. But it was a small town. Most everybody knew most everybody else. I had one brother who was just 14 months older than me, who beat me up regularly. And usually in good fun. But I played lots of sports, loved sports. We lived, after I was 7 years old, on a small river. And so I got to love anything to do with water. I became a competitive swimmer and did kayaking and scuba diving, like you mentioned. And so part of that just developed to be safe growing up right on a river. But so, you know, life was very much like sort of a Tom Sawyer, like small town, semi-rural life, you know, catching frogs and turtles and fishing and small school. So, you know, all the sort of typical things when we were teenagers of getting into trouble and staying out of trouble, racing cars. So, but it, you know, having a very secure base, I think, prepared me well to go out into life, be adventurous, open to a lot of different experiences. And so that's how I've tried to live.
So let me ask you, and thanks for sharing. When I was in the Navy, I was stationed in Indiana. How far, I wasn't in Bloomington, I was about 45 minutes from Bloomington, but how far, Indiana has so many small states, it's like new cities, it's like New Jersey. How far is Goshen from Bloomington?
Well, Goshen is at the very top of the state. It's just about 12 miles below the Michigan line. So, you know, Bloomington, okay. You know, Indianapolis is right in the middle, and Bloomington is southwest of Indy. And so Goshen is almost due north from Indy.
Okay. When you were a kid growing up, I used to love to read the Mark Twain and the Tom Sawyer books. As a kid, when you were a little boy, what did you dream of being when you grew up?
A sports star. One of my favorite books or series of books was called the Chip Hilton Sports Series. And I've actually, one of my books called Hero's Journey describes my love of reading those books and the character of Chip Hilton, who was just the, you know, the perfect boy. And so I wanted to, you know, be like Chip until I was a teenager, and then decided Chip was kind of a drip because he never did anything wrong, never got into trouble. So missed out on a lot of the fun of adolescence. But yeah, as a little kid, I just, you know, I loved sports and thought the greatest life in the world would be like being an NFL quarterback or NBA point guard. But unfortunately, my athletic ability falls far short of that level.
Oh, but see, you still did pretty good. the achievements you did make in with the swimming and the other sports that you played. You enjoyed reading these books about Chip. Who or what inspired? Was it those books? Who got you into reading books? Where did your passion for writing and reading books come from?
Well, I grew up in a family that was very much in the newspaper business. My step grandfather was the editor of our local paper, the Goshen News.
Oh.
My mom became the city editor. She was a reporter there. And my stepfather became the editor following my step grandfather. So I was around journalist writers growing up all the time and really loved going down to the newspaper and just seeing how things work there. But also I had in Goshen some really great English and literature teachers who loved literature and, you know, just reading the books that we were assigned in school, I liked almost every book we ever had to read. And in the summer, our library had this program where if you read 20 books during the summer, you got a little ribbon. And so, you know, a few summers I did that. And even though I loved being outdoors and loved playing sports, there was also that, you know, solitary side of me that could just lose myself in a book.
I find that fascinating. I mean, I love to read, and I started writing when I was 10 years old. So your family's involved in this newspaper, the local newspaper. How old were you when you knew for certain that you were going to be a writer?
Writing was always important to me from the time I was in junior high school. I started writing poetry, which was probably pretty bad stuff, you know, kind of whiny adolescent kind of writing that only my teachers and best friends might have seen, because, you know, nobody would publish it. But then in college, I got a little more serious, had, as you mentioned, a few poems published and a short story in college publications. And so from that time on, it was something I always did, but it was never my primary focus until after I retired from law. So
really?
Yeah. I mean, I practiced law for 30 years, and if you're a lawyer, and other than family, if law is not your primary focus, you're not going to do very well. And I was, you know, I wanted to do very well, and law was very good to me. And because of the financial success I had in law and business and investing, I was able to retire at 56 and then, you know, make writing more of a primary focus. And so I had my first book published the year I retired. But before that, I wrote a lot of articles that were published, but, you know, just didn't have the time to devote to a full-length book.
And your articles were probably on law, I'm guessing. Now, how much of your work? So you have a very interesting story. The character Chip, you wanted to be in sports, whether a point guard in the NBA or a quarterback in the NFL, and then you said no, and you went into law. Even though your family is running the local newspaper and you love to read, so you have a very interesting story, and I'm sure our listeners, when I ask this next question, are going to probably be like, wow, this guy has really done a lot of things, from sports to the books you read to the articles you've written to law. And so then this other question might throw some of our listeners off a little bit, but I wanted to ask you, how much of your work, your writing work, is affected by your experience of hitchhiking? It's just almost amazing. I'm like, no, you couldn't have practiced law for 30 years. And then you hitchhike. Is a lawyer to me just I don't know, the image you have of a lawyer is just not someone who would do this. But how much of your work is affected by your experience of hitchhiking across the United States?
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting you asked me that question today, because I just finished sending off an op-ed article, and we'll see if it gets published or not, about hitchhiking giving me a perspective on the polarization of our country. So when I was 18, I hitchhiked from Goshen, Indiana, down to Key West, Florida, so as far south
wow.
as you can go. And then the next year, when I was 19, with a buddy, we hitchhiked from L.A. back to Goshen, Indiana, so as far west as you could go. And so I've hitchhiked, you know, really virtually across the entire country within the space of a year in 18 and 19. And it was an incredible experience. I mean, I met all kinds of people that I would have never met in Goshen, Indiana. I mean, just to give you an example of one amazing person, a guy in a red brand new Ferrari picks me up on I-65 north of Birmingham, Alabama, drives me all the way to Indiana. And this guy is in a Ferrari, but he has decided to model his life after Jesus. And every car we saw that seemed to have any trouble or anybody we saw along the way that needed help, we would stop. He would either give them money, we'd push them out of a snowbank, he'd buy them gas, we'd help them fix a flat tire. So we made rather slow progress. But, I mean, that's you just meet weird and amazing people. And I wouldn't recommend hitchhiking to anybody because it could be dangerous.
Yeah.
But in all those miles I hitchhiked, I had a couple cars that I got into that I was a little worried and for a few minutes scared. But, you know, I never had a bad experience. And so it was very influential in terms of opening me to just being willing to engage with people that were very different from me. So this piece I just wrote is the argument it makes is that Americans really at heart are very open, trusting people. And I believed that for a long time because of those experiences. But now the country's gotten so polarized that we distrust people we disagree with, and we, you know, demonize people we disagree with. And so my argument is that now with the new Biden-Harris administration and Joe Biden giving what I think was a really wonderful acceptance speech talking about the true character of Americans being open and trusting, my hope is, and the encouragement of that article, is that we move back in that direction. So
yeah,
it's just what a coincidence you asked me that question.
Yeah, we have to get back to, and I think some of the focus, like some corporations are doing, really focusing on encouraging people to bring their whole self to work, and whether you're in a wheelchair or you work and you have autism or you're blind or you're LGBT or whatever your background, some corporations are really having serious discussions, open, candid discussions. We got to accept each other, and hopefully that might also help. But yeah, we just because somebody disagrees with you is not like you doesn't mean you have to shut them out or, like you say, demonize them. Now, tell us about your book. So you had all these hitchhiking experiences, and I came up in a time when I know in the, I think it was the 70s. I was born in the 60s. I remember in the 70s when people used to hitchhike. You need a ride to work, you just go out on the road and you'd hitchhike. And it was safe, and then bad things started to happen, and they would say on the news, don't hitchhike for a ride. So things may have started changing even sooner than we might imagine, but tell us about your book, You Have to Get Lost. I love the title. You have to get lost before you can be found.
Yeah, thanks. Well, that's actually my second to last book because I just had another one published last month. But You Have to Get Lost Before You Can Be Found is a series of adventures in the Himalayas. And it covers my 25 years of trekking and climbing in the Himalayas, but introduces people to the culture of Nepal and northern India, the Himalayan region, Tibet, and sort of describes what it's like to visit that area, what it's like to climb and trek. And then it's sort of the fundamental point of it is that being alone and lost can be scary, exciting, but ultimately meaning is always found within a community. And so the very last chapter in the book describes an experience where I actually got lost on a mountain. I was separated from my climbing team, and fog rolled in, and visibility was so minimal. Yeah, I couldn't see, and so I spent half a day, so from about late morning until after sundown, thrashing around, trying to find my way back to our base camp. And so it describes that feeling of desolation and anxiety of being alone, and then how wonderful it is to be reunited with, you know, with your community. And so it's a very, you know, sort of poignant, extreme description of the value of community. So that's the underlying theme that is woven into the adventure stories and the cultural and historical information that's provided through the book.
Oh my gosh. Oh my God. I can only imagine. Oh, I can just see myself lost. Like, oh my God, screaming, calling people's names. I'm like, oh my God. And everywhere you go, you're like, oh no, that's not the way. And then God, no. And am I getting further and further away from them? It's like, oh, my gosh. So tell us about your latest book, what's the title of your most recent book, and if you could tell us a little about that book.
Sure, thanks. The title is Anarchist Republican Assassin, A Political Novel. So I've written... Of the 11 books I've written, 4 are novels, and so, you know, I mostly write nonfiction, and that's my background. But I like, and as you do too, you know, I mean, you're diverse, like me, in your writing, so you can understand that. Although, you know, fiction is very nonfiction is very meaningful because you're trying to tell the truth directly through nonfiction about something that's important to you, but you can also do that, you know, through a novel. And so that's what inspired this novel was the night after the George Floyd murder by cop in Minneapolis. I saw images on TV of Minneapolis and then other cities exploding from protests into riots, and it reminded me so much. It was just such a viscerally powerful memory of back in the late 60s and early 70s, seeing those very same images on TV, and then actually twice, and once when I was hitchhiking, I was in a protest that turned into a violent riot. And out of that, for some reason that I can't explain rationally, this character just popped into my mind, and it was one of those things where the character was just so fully developed that I started writing about this character. And he was an anarchist revolutionary in the late 60s and early 70s. He was in the 1968 police riot in Chicago and eventually left the anarchist sort of violent revolutionary movement to go to business school, got a business degree, became a very successful businessman, joined the Republican establishment in Indianapolis, and then he experiences the riots and protests following George Floyd's murder and enters a psychotic state. And because he blames what's sort of gone wrong with the country on Donald Trump, he wants to seek revenge against Trump in this psychotic state. And what happens next, I won't tell you, because that's the sort of, there's two mystery endings. And so what happens with him is one, and then he has a young lawyer who's trying to help him. And what happens with her as his lawyer is another mystery to be solved in the book.
Okay. And what's the title again?
Anarchist Republican Assassin.
Oh. And is the his attorney, are they a couple? Can you say that or no?
No. In fact, one of the things that drives him into his psychotic state is his wife of 30-some years just died, and he's struggling with that when the pandemic hits and he's all alone. And so this young, rather attractive attorney comes into his life, and there's definitely some sparks there.
Oh, okay. Now, so you're watching this, and this character, it's amazing how characters and books, where they come from. It just came into your mind out of nowhere. That being, I'm just curious, is this your first novel by any chance?
No, it's my fourth novel.
So how long, being that this just came up out of nowhere, sometimes as a writer you have to work to create the story, and I've had to work hard on some. I get an idea and then I'm like, I don't know if I'm even sticking with it. I have to work so hard at it. And then some just come up, like this for you. Was this a quick, easy for you to create this novel?
It was amazingly quick and easy. It's the fastest, in terms of time, that I've ever written a book. Like the one before, you have to get lost before you can be found, took the better part of a year. This took about 2.5 months.
Yeah. It's some stories, they're just there. It's like they're on this like silver platter, and all you have to do is start typing or start writing. And it sounds very, very interesting and timely for the things that, you know, the country is still dealing with. I want to go back to one of your other books. When you were, the acute mountain sickness that you had, was that a part of your book, You Have to Get Lost Before You Get Found? When you were lost there, were you, is that when you developed that acute mountain sickness? And what is that?
Well, acute mountain sickness is high, or also called high altitude sick. What it is physiologically is when you get into up to a high altitude, there's less oxygen in the air. And when you breathe inhale, oxygen is then goes into your red blood cells. The red blood cells, oxygenated, take that to your brain, and that the oxygen taken to your brain in your red blood cells is what really gives you functionality. And so as there's less oxygen in the air, less oxygen is getting to your brain, and the body adapts to that. And so it will pump more red blood cells to your brain, but sometimes something will go wrong and it can't keep up. As you're losing oxygen, your body's not pumping enough red blood cells to your brain, and then your brain starts shutting your body down. So first you'll experience headaches from lack of oxygen, then usually you'll experience nausea, and then the third stage is called ataxia, where you lose muscle control and it becomes hard to walk, stand. And then the fourth stage is death. And I have managed to get to the third stage three different times. And it's really awful. And what I eventually concluded is that even though I love being up in high altitudes in the mountains, I'm genetically predisposed to getting, altitude sickness. And so Sir Edmund Hillary, you know, the greatest climber of all time in some ways, first person along with Tenzing Norgay, his partner, to summit Mount Everest, got it so bad once he had a brain embolism and lung embolism almost killed him. And so he had to quit climbing because of that. It's a really terrible feeling. But the thing is, there's a real easy cure for it. As soon as you experience those headaches, all you have to do is go down, you lose altitude, and you wait a day or two, your body will adjust to it, and then you can resume going back up. The trouble is when you're on a climbing team, on an expedition, there's a schedule. Everything is scheduled. So if you have to go back down and lose a couple days, you're off schedule. So because climbers are usually type A personalities who want to get to the top, you know, who are very kind of driven, we tend not to want to go down, and we keep going up when we should be going down, and then we get into trouble. And I've done that stupidly, but have managed to live to tell the tale and write about it in that book.
Well, you sound like I have my bias around attorneys. You're really, really shattering them. Oh my God, I just can't believe that you practiced law for 30 years. Can you share I want to talk about your book, False Prophet, as well, but can you share 2 to 3 experiences that you cover in the book? I can only imagine how our listeners will enjoy your interview, and those who listen to it in the archives, listen to how you explore, and you seem to be this free spirit. But if you can share 2 to 3 key experiences that you cover in your book from your visit to Bassa, and where is that?
Well, Bassa is a little village that's directly east of Kathmandu. Kathmandu is the capital of Nepal, biggest city in Nepal. And if you went due east about 100 miles or so, you might be able to find Bassa. Excuse me. When I first started going there, there was no road that got there. There is now. But so when I visited Bassa until the very last time, a couple of years ago, we would drive to the end of the road, get off, and then would walk for 4 days to get to the village. Or you could fly to a little airstrip. There's a little airport in a bigger village called Paplu. And it's a day and a half walk to Bassa from there. So,
how many hours a day are you walking?
Well, it's, you know, it depends. The first time I went to Bassa, which is described in a book called my mind is blanking on the
Island Adventures.
No, Paradise. Anyway, It was in 2008, and the group that started was 10, and the group that actually made it to Basso was 3. And all sorts of things went wrong. Three of our members actually didn't get on the flight to Kathmandu. And then along the way, we lost 4 more members who got hurt or got sick or just wanted to quit because we had planned to fly to Paplu, but we couldn't because a plane had crashed and they shut down the airport. And so we had to drive and then walk, and we were way behind schedule. So we were walking, we were doing 12-hour days, and it was just too tough for several of our members.
Wow.
But three of us made it. And when we got to the village, every single resident, and there were about 250 people waiting for us with leis, necklaces of flowers that they had handmade. And they literally covered the three of us in flowers. And we were given the most wonderful welcome I've ever experienced anywhere, anytime in my entire life. Every family wanted to host us, wanted to feed us, wanted to give us their homebrew. And we were treated like rock stars or royalty, because I had started the year before the Basso Foundation, and our first project was to finish their little village school, which had 3 grades, and with $5,000, they were able to add to the building, add 2 more classrooms, and hire 2 teachers. Teachers back then were paid $40 per month. And so for $5,000, we added 2 grades and hired 2 teachers and were able to pay their salary for several years out of that money. It's got to be the best, the most far-reaching investment
Wow.
$5,000 has ever done.
Well, thank you. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, so then
Wow.
the foundation since then has grown and we've done water projects, hydroelectric projects, another school, a medical clinic, and a bunch of other smaller projects in the area.
Oh, my goodness. Now I got to ask you this before we talk about island adventures. You making me want to just get on a plane and go travel somewhere. Now, you've explored islands and the mountains. Can you tell us about island adventures for those who, particularly with this COVID and people not traveling? One thing about a good thing about books, you can read a book and the person's telling you about their experiences and where they traveled, and by the time you put the book down, you don't feel like you're on lockdown so much. You feel like you've gone on this journey. So can you give us an overview of island adventures, and where are some of the places that you visited and you talk about in the book?
Sure. The book is a series of short stories, articles that were all of them were published in journals and magazines. And so over the years, that's a lot of the articles I wrote were about these travel adventures I had. And a bunch of them were on islands around the Caribbean and the South Pacific. And so that it describes things like solo kayaking in Palau, which is a small island nation south of the Philippines, and getting lost at night on a kayak out at sea by myself and thinking, this is not going to end well because I don't, I've been paddling all day and I don't have the strength to paddle back to where... because I overshot a docking place, and there was nowhere else to dock the kayak, but had this amazing, really mystical experience of singing and praying and chanting by myself out in the ocean, and all of a sudden I just felt this powerful strength that I could paddle for another 12 hours if I had to, and paddled around the side of this island that, you know, was impassable up to the dock where I could put up my tent and sleep for the night. And as I rounded this the corner of the island to come into this little bay or inlet, the sky had been completely dark. Clouds had covered, blocked out the moon, blocked out the stars, and all of a sudden it was like a curtain was drawn, and the moon was so bright, the stars were bright, and it just lit up this bay in this wonderful, sort of beautiful, welcoming sense that I was safely there. And so that's, you know, that's one of the many experiences.
Wow, man, you got experiences that, oh my gosh, you have to, these are things you have to do to get these experiences. Oh my goodness, I am just so in awe of you to travel and to, you just, you don't talk yourself out of stuff, it seems like. You go ahead and you do what it is that you want to do. Now, between the mountains and the islands, I got to ask you, which place, so you just described a wonderful experience. You were lost, you started singing and praying, and you feel this empowerment coming in from your inner self. But between all your adventures, which place was easier for you to unwind and to find peace in? And why do you think this place had that effect on you?
Yeah, that's really hard to choose, because up in the mountains, it's just so, the majestic beauty of the mountains is so moving that, you know, you just look all around and these gorgeous white peaks are there. But on an island, when, you know, as long as it's not storming, the lapping of the waves on a sandy beach and looking out over this vast ocean is so calming. So I would say probably my experience in islands, in terms of that calmness and serenity, that's where I found that. And that the book, Island Adventures, and the subtitle is disconnecting from, you know, modern busy life and getting away from your normal sort of overstimulated life. And how I've experienced that on islands, because there's something about an island, you know, it's all self-contained, you know, everything you need is there, and yet it's isolated from the rest of the world. And it's just, there's something serene and beautiful about that that's always appealed to me. So when I wasn't going up into the mountains and I could get away, I would go and disconnect on an island. One of the stories in that book is about doing nothing, where one time I went to this island in the French Polynesia that's had only a handful of people living on it, and just to spend time. And my goal was to spend a week where there was nothing, literally nothing to do, except eat and sleep, swim, snorkel. And that turned out to be very challenging. I mean, I found myself, you know, wanting to do things, wanting to have activities, but I was determined to experience just a week of meditation and being by myself. And it became wonderful. But at first, the first couple of days where it was quite difficult just to, as I say in the subtitle, to disconnect. But eventually,
wow, you know what?
It took a while and I found it.
You're giving me an idea, and that's, I was thinking about something coming up, like, what am I going to do? I may try what you tried for a week and see what happens. before we talk about false prophet, one last question. Did you really look a well in the eye in Tonga? Were you scared, or what was that experience like? Were you in the ocean? Did that really happen?
Yeah. In fact, that was another almost, well, I wouldn't say almost, I would say mystical experience. I was on a, with a group where we were going whale watching, and some other guys I had met came up on a small speedboat and said, you know, we're gonna actually swim with the whales if we can. You want to come with us? So I jumped off the whale watching boat onto their boat, and we would. There was a father, a mother, and a little calf, baby whale, in the area. So we would chase them, jump out of the boat with our fins and snorkel and mask, and try to swim over to the whales. And the male, the father, eventually just took off. So there was just the mother and the calf. And what they would do, it was like they were playing tag with us. They would wait for us, but then as we got closer, they would swim away. And we did this 5 or 6 times. The boat captain said, okay, this is the last time, we're low on fuel. So there were four of us dive in, start swimming. The other three guys tired out, but because I had been a competitive swimmer, I guess I had a little more endurance. I kept going, and after about 200 more yards, the mama and baby just stopped. And I swam right up to them. The mother, this huge eye, was just looking at me.
Wow.
Through my mask, looked right into her eye. And then she moved her fin. The baby was on the other side. She, like, caressed her baby with her fin. The baby swam under her, and the baby came right up to me and let me pet it. And of course, the baby was longer than me, but so I got to touch the baby and look into the. And then after about 5 minutes, with one big flap of her tail and with her baby kind of tucked under her fin, she took off.
Oh my goodness! See, oh my gosh! Like a Robert Crusoe or what his name was. On off the shelf. Now I want to ask you, we're coming down to the home stretch in today's interview, and what a treat you have been. Where did you get the idea for the book, False Prophet? Where did the idea for that book come from?
Well, it's a novel, but it was inspired by a case I had as a lawyer. There was an inner-city African-American preacher who had a dream of taking this little cinder block church he had and eventually turning it into a big cathedral with a youth center and a community center. And he had this beautiful vision. And over 25 years, he'd been acquiring, slowly but surely, all the vacant properties and rundown houses in this really blighted neighborhood, and to try to fulfill his vision. And all of a sudden, the vision was dashed because our local newspaper, the Indianapolis Star, did a story, big feature story about him, calling him a slumlord, and really, really trashing his reputation. And what turned out was that the city and the federal government and several major real estate developers in the area had gotten together and decided to develop that area and build townhouses and condos and bring in yuppies. And they had this big vision for the area, and he was standing in their way. So all of a sudden the story was done, and then he had never had any trouble with the tax authorities, and all of a sudden he's got liens. The state tax is alleging that all these properties were not being used for church purposes, and they're hitting him with thousands, tens of thousands of dollars in tax liens. And so I represented him, tried to fight this battle. We lost. I took it all the way up to the Indiana Supreme Court. We lost. We did get tax relief for him, but he eventually gave up, and the properties were sold or sold off. And that was so upsetting, I decided to write a novel based on sort of with him as a character, only it turns out right instead of wrong in the end, which is a wonderful thing about fiction.
And so yeah, it's front- you can say, oh my
yeah,
God.
Yeah,
so
you can change you- reality.
Yes, can you introduce us to Jack Ross? What is he like? And I'm assuming he's the preacher. But what is Jack Ross like?
But Jack Ross is actually his lawyer.
Okay.
Yeah, the preacher, Elder Brown, Jack and he developed this really, I think, wonderful relationship because they're very different. Jack is an atheist or an agnostic. He was the star litigator in a big downtown Indianapolis silk stocking law firm, but ends up leaving the firm because his best friend got kicked out of the firm. And so out of loyalty to his best friend, he leaves. And then the two of them are like bottom feeders in the legal world, scrapping and struggling to make a living, taking any case they can get. And, you know, their lives have changed from being at the top to being at the bottom, at least of the law profession. And Reverend Brown comes into their office one day with this case because he's been defamed by the Indianapolis Star and wants help. And that's where their relationship starts.
Oh, and who is Clevon Saunders? And how do Jack and Clevon get to know each other?
Well, Clevon was a young black attorney who had been working under Jack in the big law firm. And they had become good friends. Jack was his mentor. But unfortunately, it turns out the big law firm is going to represent the Indianapolis Star. So they're now on opposite sides in this case. And Clevon is really torn because he feels like he owes Jack for having sort of having mentored him. But on the other hand, he's ambitious and wants to rise up within the firm. And so they have this conflict. And then Jack's mentor within the firm is the head attorney on the other side of the case. So there's also that conflict of loyalty. And it turns out Jack's mentor is actually a real son of a bitch. Sort of, when you imagine the, dirty, conniving sort of attorney who will do anything to win, well, that's that guy. And then, unfortunately, the case is originally filed in Indianapolis where Jack thinks he's going to get a jury that will be mixed, have black folks, white folks on it, and, he'll get a fair shake. It gets venued out into a rural county with a crusty old judge who seems like he's probably a racist, and this is the guy Jack has to convince that he's on the right side.
Oh,
so there's
God,
another
this looks
challenging.
So
really.
Good. Oh, my gosh. It sounds so good. When you first start thinking the title, False Prophet, I think it's a pastor or somebody who's just gone so wrong. But this sounds so good. What have readers been saying about False Prophet?
Well, the readers who are into, legal thrillers, have been complimentary. I mean, John Grisham is the king of that genre, and I have to admit, I've admired Grisham. I also think there's some problems with his style, but anyway, he was certainly influential in the way I approached the book, because I wanted to show sort of the full range of what it's like being a big city attorney. There's, you know, the bottom feeders and the elite silk stocking big firms. And then I think readers have found the character of the preacher really poignant. I mean, he's, you know, he has this beautiful vision that's in jeopardy. And then there's an arson and a murder mystery that are woven into the narrative. So it's a mystery, has a surprising but, you know, fulfilling ending. So, you know, the people who like legal thrillers and mysteries and crime dramas relate to the book.
Okay. I have to ask you, what type of writing process do you follow? Do you work with outlines? Do you do character sketches? How do you start to flesh out a novel?
Yeah, it's really, I don't have one method. The process has been different, especially for the novels. The fiction is usually, like both of the ones we've talked about, were inspired by an experience or a character that just sort of took off in my mind. The nonfiction, I've tended to follow a more traditional process of having a central theme that I wanted to develop, and then I've usually either done an outline or at least, you know, sort of written out the way I see the book developing, and then, you know, just sat down and wrote page after page. I tend to be very programmatic in terms of starting on page one, working my way to the end, not skipping around or skipping ahead. You know, not doing a character sketch, but just having the character develop as the story develops. So
okay.
That's, yeah. So kind of, in a way it sounds kind of messy, but, it's worked.
Yeah. You still get done what you set out to do. Can you share 3 to 4 steps that you found to be effective at getting the word out about your stories and your books?
Well, I would say I haven't been as effective in doing that as more successful authors have been. My first full-length book, which is Bringing Progress to Paradise, the one I couldn't remember the title to, was published with a traditional publisher, and I didn't have an agent. I just submitted directly to the publisher, and they liked the idea, so they took it, and I worked with the editor. So that was pretty lucky. But then I was sort of disappointed with the way they marketed the book, and then right after that, and so this is, we're back in 2010, the Amazon KDP method of direct publishing came out, and my wife, who's actually a much more successful writer than me, she's done 27 books and
wow.
Had many historical novels and some writing craft books published by traditional publishers. We both thought, wouldn't it be cool to try out this Amazon KDP thing? And I had False Prophet done. So there's a finished manuscript. And so we spent 2 days, I mean, hours and hours, trying to figure out how to self-publish or direct publish that book. But we eventually got it done, and I since revised and polished it more. So this is the one that's available now is actually a second version of it. But we figured out how to do it, and have even since then we started our own little company, Midsummer Books, and have worked with a whole bunch of other authors to help them go through successfully that same process. And so I'm kind of circling a long way around your question, but the marketing part of it, I've never been in love with that. And so I have something of a social media platform. I make my books known when they come out through that. I do what we're doing right now. I've been the guest on over 100 radio shows and podcasts over the years, which I love doing this. I mean, I love talking with people like you, Denise. And so I've given talks and goal civic and church groups in Indianapolis and Chicago. But the one thing I haven't really done that I think I should is to use Amazon, Facebook, Twitter advertising. And so this last book, Anarchist Republican Assassin, I finally decided I'm going to do that and buy some ads on the social media to promote that book. And guess what? All of the social media platforms and Amazon have banned political advertising.
Wow.
And so when I tried to put up my ads, all of them rejected the ads because this is a political book. At first I tried to fight it, and I responded and I said, look, this is a novel. It's fiction. It's kind of an anti-Trump novel, but it's fiction, and they've banned it. And I'm waiting for a reply from Amazon as to, are they going to eventually lift the ban after the whole controversy of who won the election is over, or is this a forever ban? And I'm waiting for their answer.
Yeah, and maybe in the meantime, false prophet. You could work false prophet with some Amazon sponsored ads or a Facebook ad. I actually have had some ads recently on my book Long Woke Up. It's not political, but it's about an orphan who becomes a president in Africa. Just that word. I had to redo it so I could get it through. We're out of time. Got to ask you this definitely. Where can off the shelf listeners get copies of your books?
Well, they're all available through Amazon or through my website, which you mentioned at the beginning, jeffreyrasley.com. So go to the website or even just Google my name and you'll find my page on Amazon.
Oh, what a treat. What a treat. Oh, my goodness. I know off the shelf listeners enjoy Jeff Rosley today. Again, his website is jeffreyrasley.com. You guys got to check out his books and his travel adventures. He's an attorney and he's novel writing and doing all this traveling. And oh, my goodness. So I want to thank Jeff Rosley for being here with us this morning and some of his books that we talked about. Polarized, Hero's Journey, Island Adventures, Bringing Progress to Paradise, False Prophet, and then his latest one that he's trying to get accepted for advertisement through Amazon, Facebook, etc. Oh, my goodness. Encourage you to support him again, Jeff Rosley, Rasley, and get copies of his books. Thank you so much, Jeff. And to all of our off-the-shelf listeners, thank you for being here with us on this Saturday. Remember, you are incredible. You're phenomenal. You're amazing. Go out and create an awesome day for yourself today. Jeff, I'll shoot you an email with a link to the show when it finishes streaming. Thank you again. Bye for now.
Bye-bye. Thank you so much, Denise.